You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, no, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Brian O'Reilly for the past couple of hours, but now, at just past midday, it's time for another Bums on Seats. For the next hour, it's all cinema as we discuss and debate the new film releases screening in and around the Cambridge area. My name is Toby Miller, and with me in the studio today are Bridget Bradshaw.
Hello.
Ashley Capaldi.
Hello.
Simon West.
Hello.
And Jack Toy.
Hello.
All three of the new films we're looking at today focus on characters that shake up button-down communities, for better or for worse. Maggie Smith stars as the cantankerous pensioner who slips through society's cracks and sets up camp in Alan Bennett's front garden in The Lady in the Van. Kate Winslet plays the fashionista who returns to her hometown with a sewing machine and a notion of revenge in The Dressmaker. And Michael Fassbender is the polo-necked P.T. Barnum revolutionising home computing in Danny Boyle's ambitious biopic Steve Jobs. Plus, we'll repeat our interview with Alison Rose, director of documentary Starmen, which enjoyed its UK premiere during September's Cambridge Film Festival and is now back on general release. And we'll take a quick look at the plans for monthly screenings of Addingtonian cinema in Cambridge. So, lots to come, but we'll start the hour with an unwelcome guest.
You're not St. John, are you?
St. John who?
The disciple whom Jesus loved.
No, the name's Bennett.
An educated woman and living in a van.
I'm studying incognito at Paris.
But what? What were you studying?
Music. The pianoforte.
Last year she was in Gloucester Avenue, now it's our turn.
Were you planning on staying long?
Mr. Bennett, the ideal would be off-street parking.
We were just saying how grateful she'll be.
Yes. Would you like to push me up the street?
Not particularly, no.
Looking especially lovely today, sweetheart.
Don't sweetheart me. I'm dying, possibly.
Chin up, love. We all got to go sometime. Smells like you already have.
It's been a successful month for British film. James Bond and Spectre still dominate the multiplex like a popcorn-hungry despot and is only now ceding ground to Maggie Smith, the star attraction of Alan Bennett's The Lady in the Van. Directed by Nicholas Heitner and adapted by Bennett himself, The Lady in the Van is careful to offer more than a simple reproduction of the original stage version, weaving flashbacks and doppelgangers into a story that began life as a simple memoir. Alex Jennings plays two Alan Bennetts, one who interacts with the world outside his Camden home and one who scribbles these interactions into possible scenarios. Both these Bennetts are increasingly fascinated by the street's most eccentric resident, Maggie Smith's mysterious Miss Shepherd. Despite seeming to have money to hand, Miss Shepherd chooses to sleep rough in her crumbling edifice of a van, layered in coats, unwashed in goodness knows how long, and with a temper only matched by her devout Catholicism. Jack, to start with you, though I know everybody in the room's seen this, the poster, the trailer, the marketing for Lady in the Van suggests the cosy and heartwarming British comedy of manners, and certainly the full auditorium I saw this film in with were expecting that. But is there an edge to the last? Because it is Alan Bennett, after all.
I don't know. Well, an edge can be many an edgy thing. I'd say there is a melancholy edge to it, which I wasn't expecting, and it's not from lovely Miss Shepherd, tramp lady in your driveway, and it's not from Alan Bennett's mother in a home. It's from Alan Bennett, and I found there's something extremely sad about his character that I can't quite put my finger on. But I think Alex Jennings,
yes,
his name? He displays really well. The film has smashed it totally. I've got some stats, if you'd like, a couple of brief stats. I know
every show should have stats.
So, some comparable films, maybe. So, Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, in its opening week, had a box office gross of £2.2 million. The Iron Lady, everyone's favourite Margaret Thatcher film, had £2.15 million. And Lady in the Van, £2.26 million. So, it's in the pole position. And Cambridge Arts Picture House, not only is the best performing picture house site for it, it's the second best cinema in the whole UK for Lady in the Van, topped only by View West End, which has an average ticket price of £15.99.
There we
are. So Cambridge loves Lady in the Van.
I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that, really.
That's all my stats.
I don't know. Yeah. Okay, all right, good. Glad you came along.
There we go now. For any James Corden fans out there, don't come to this film expecting any more James Corden than the James Corden you see in the trailer, because that's his only scene in the whole film. I really enjoyed it. It's not necessarily the feel-good Friday film I was expecting, but it definitely moved me. And I think Maggie Smith must sleep in some kind of cryogenic bed, because she looks the same in this film as she did in The Secret Garden, which I'm pretty sure was a children's film that came out when I was a kid.
90s Secret Garden is.
So whatever she's using,
more creased, I think, than the 90s.
All right. Let's not have a go at Maggie Smith on air. She was.
Oh no, we'll get shot by Secret Services.
She is in her 80s now. So,
but in the words of Ralph Fiennes in Grand Budapest Hotel, whatever she's using, I want some, darling.
So true. Bridget, is it? They come to you next. I didn't expect to like the Lady in the Van. I'm sort of slightly impervious to what I thought was going to be a cosy British film, but I found it a fairly depressing experience, and I think that was part and parcel of what the film was about. How did you take it?
Yes, I mean, a lot of the neighbours who interact with her, they want to help and she doesn't want their help, or she doesn't accept their help, and they just feel so guilty. And it was quite painful to watch this carrying on for 15 years.
It doesn't paint a good... I think that's it. It doesn't... It sort of depicts a... You expect more from Alan Bennett because it's Alan Bennett, but it's, on the surface, it is them looking after... Or he looking after this elderly lady, but then it's sort of... But it's much more of a sort of state of the nation piece, really, as it catches a Britain that's sliding towards yuppiedom and Thatcherism and all sorts of things, even though it starts in the 1970s.
Yes. Something that struck me was whenever any carers came along, the people in ambulances, anyone that helped her from a medical perspective, they were almost like a different species, the way they approached her.
Yeah, it was. I was thinking, because of the very first scene in the film, and maybe not the very first scene, but the is this sort of jib shot of the street that, well, Alan Bennett's buying his house, and we see the fireplace of one of these old houses being taken out as gentrification happens to the neighbourhood, and these new sort of wet liberals move in and not quite sure what to do with their wealth and feeling guilty about it. I thought that was... Simon, did you find it more of a sort of... Because a state of the nation rather than
I did find it a fascinating study on liberal guilt. Which is, you know, shot throughout this film about how these, you know, rich, arty liberals handle something when, you know, like a homeless person comes right in the middle of their environment. And it just seems an inconvenience to deal with. And they kind of want to help, but they don't want to get their hands dirty. And it just, you know, put a fascinating background on in the entire film.
These are the children of the swinging 60s, in a way.
It's not just Alan Bennett, it's the Vaughan Williams, I didn't realise, you know, his neighbours and things like that. You know, they're going off to the opera and, you know, getting all the kids to play the violins to try and drive off this old lady because she doesn't like the noise and doesn't like the music anymore.
They never seem to... Yeah, you're right, they never seem to grasp, they never seem to try to understand, but neither does Alan Bennett, actually. I think, as Jack's pointed out, and I'll come to Ashley here, that is sort of the undertone of all of this, is a dislike that Alan Bennett, the writer, has for Alan Bennett, the character, in this film. Everybody says to him during the film, oh, you're so caring to bring in Miss Shepherd, and he's quite rightly says, well, no, I don't like the word caring, and as he refers to himself, he's sort of supine and ruthless at the same time, and I think it's that thread of dislike that gives the film its sour taste.
Yeah, like Jack was saying, the edge is Alan Bennett, and it's his character is a difficult one to like. He's adorable in a way, but he's just so empty, and that's the reason he allows this woman to live on his property for 15 years. I think everyone else has that liberal guilt, but Alan needs her. So he says, I didn't choose, I was chosen, but he seems happy to be. He's just, there's nothing else that he has in his life. He wanted her there, I think. He needed her there, definitely.
It's just a matter of convenience to bring her into the drive. She was parked outside. She was being bothered by local yobs, but it was easier to bring her in the drive than actually send her away entirely, though obviously he didn't expect her to stay for 15 years. It's... Bridget, come back to you. Maggie Smith has played this role three times now. She played it on stage. The role was written for her by Alan Bennett. A real person was adapted for Maggie Smith, rather. And then she's played the role on radio. Is there a danger that maybe it's... I don't expect Maggie Smith to ever be lazy in a performance, but it might be a little bit too polished, because she wasn't a nice lady. She wasn't Goebbels, but she wasn't... And she was right-wing. She was wanted to be more right-wing than Margaret Thatcher. She was not an entirely pleasant person, and her views weren't entirely pleasant. Is it difficult? Is there a danger that she's simply just not cute, but there's still an edge to the character?
Well, I've not seen the play and I've not heard the radio, so this was my first experience with Alan Bennett, I think. And I thought she was marvellously prickly. I wouldn't want her living on my drive. The backstory, as we learnt more about what's driven her to behave the way she does, she did it very well, obviously.
But does that help soften? Yes. Does it help soften? Because we don't know, without doing a huge amount of research, and I couldn't find out the differences between the film version and the stage version, we don't know how much of her past that Alan Bennett is finding out and how much is being dramatised. And the film actually says this, this didn't happen, you're making this up for dramatic purposes. The film's use of her past does soften her. It generates an extra sadness, but it does soften her into without going any deeper into that, which I found a little bit problematic. It questions the religion she wanted to pursue without actually criticising it.
I think it ties in a bit to the way everyone sort of wants to help her, if there were a way she could be helped. And as we, the audience, learn about her past, we start to think, that is the bit that if only we could tap that part of her, she could be healed, and yet we can't because we're the audience.
And people aren't that easy to heal. You can't. Again, it's that's another thing that perhaps makes it a little bit more melancholic than some audiences will be expecting, in that she is not resolved by the end. The script offers a little bit of resolution, but she's not a tidy... You can imagine if this film had been made by Disney or somebody, or just an American studio, or a TV movie starring Betty White, this would have been a lot simpler in the resolution, I think.
It would have been Lady Gaga moving into a street.
It's not impossible.
Living in a meat van.
Well, I love the ending. I was telling Jack, it is a bit Monty Python, as you were saying before we came on air. But no, I definitely loved the ending. It's that very satisfying, if a little bit predictable, sort of sign-off for her, and the final softening. And I think she is healed at the end. That's what we were wanting all the way through, and that's we get it in spectacular fashion at the end.
It's one of the saddest scenes in the film, I found, was when she's taken away, or when she allows herself to be taken away to be cleaned, and she doesn't intend to stay, and she almost does. That was, maybe it says more about me, but that was the fear of being closeted suddenly by old age and becoming like everybody else and becoming part of a group, which she wasn't until she ends up in this home briefly. That was scary.
Well, that's one of the sad things about... Well, I'm not going to... Maybe not sad, but that's one of the slightly melancholy coats of varnish or paint to Alan Bennett, isn't it? Because he is, at the start of the film, a fairly young man, and yet he himself seems to be kind of closeted under multiple layers of cardigans and living on his own and accepting old ladies into his driveway. I believe Ashley has an interesting point about casting.
Oh, yeah. Did you spot all his history boys as his...
He does. But does that work against the film? Again, because it does it... Does
well,
it?
I didn't we've seen... it. I mean, it had the nice cameos, and it was good to see. The film isn't starring Dominic Cooper, and like it says in cinemas, he is in one scene. But, yeah, it was nice. I mean, I did... do want to point one thing out, which we have overlooked so far. We keep calling it melancholy, sad.
And I do, to be fair,
sad,
but
anything
yes.
like that. But the film is actually very, very funny. We were, you know, this group I was in, we were laughing throughout. It is very humorous film. I mean, it's Alan Bennett. You've got the sadness, you've got the melancholy, but you see the human life, and we don't think it, we're describing, like, you know, the art house film where you just want to go down and be miserable for 2 hours, whatever. Mm-hmm. It is very funny, and I think that is why it's so popular as well. Mm. We mustn't overlook that in our, you know, our quest to delve deeper into it.
But it's not... I'm going to delve deeper. It's going to be... You're quite right. There is it is funny, and I was relieved. Again, I wasn't expecting this from Alan Bennett anyway, but it wasn't funny. It didn't try to be funny in The Exotic Marigold Hotel, is that the name of that film? Where old people who swear are funny, and or old people who talk about sex are funny, and it doesn't go down that road. It's much cleverer and much more thoughtful in its jokes. What else would I expect with a playwright of Bennett's standing? Mm. Simon, to come back to you, it expands from the play, and Nicholas Heitner, who directed The History Boys and directed The Madness of King George, I think, so he has a history of working Bennett's plays into big screen extravaganzas. He expands on this. He brings in these flashbacks, and which I felt worked against the film, especially at the end when we start to see her youth in Miss Shepherd's youth in the nunnery, or before the nunnery, when she was a budding concert pianist. I thought all of that made it again, softened it too much.
No, I think it played nicely into a bit of a mystery about it. You don't know who she is. You're trying to find out what's led her to these circumstances. So I quite like the mystery element to it, with the old flashbacks dropping it in, you know, to keep your attention. Not that it was wandering anyway, but, you know, just try and identify why she's behaving like this way, how she's reacting, and how she's ended up like here. And I think without the flashbacks, he would have just ended up with just a ton of exposition right at the very end.
But do we need that? I think that's probably what I'm rebelling against a little bit, is that I didn't need that explanation. It seemed to be there. It wasn't really there for the characters in real life. Too many reallys there, sorry. It's being handed to us as part of a film narrative, and I didn't feel that was entirely in keeping with the past hour and a half, I think.
But that's where they had 15 years to learn things like this, and afterwards, and time to delve and digest. You know, this is just a cinema audience who only has an hour and a half to do that. It's just a conceit they use to give you the understanding throughout the film, dotted throughout, and well-paced. And I think without knowing who she was, if she was just an enigma at the very end, I think the film would have lost something, because it...
I think it's because she suddenly has a special talent. She was gifted in this way. I think if she'd been not a normal person, if she'd been an unremarkable person who had slipped through the cracks for one reason or another, she's still amazing because she's a person with a character, an individual. But because this layering of, oh, she was a pianist, and here she is in sepia flashback playing the piano to an audience.
Look what we've lost. She did end up the... add another layer of melancholy onto there, in comparison to her musically and artistic gifted neighbours, where when they find out at the end, when it's too late, it is almost, she is one of their own. This could happen to any of them.
They would have gone to see her in other circumstances. Obviously, yeah. Roger Allam's neighbours going to Glyndebourne at the beginning, and they're happy to watch from afar, but as you've said earlier, can't get their hands dirty.
Do you know... another interesting stat. So that street in real life...
It's like being a football programme.
Yeah. Here, Toby, I've got an interesting stat for you. So in real life, Alan Bennett's house backed onto Morrissey's house, and they were neighbours, and they'd visit each other and have cups of tea. So maybe what the film needed was Morrissey popping around a few times to be melancholy.
No film needs Morrissey.
They would have communicated through two tin cans linked by a piece of string. But anyway, all right. No. We'll wrap up there with that Morrissey fact. Lady in the Van opened last week and is still to be found taking up valuable parking space at the Arts Picture House and both View and Light Multiplex cinemas. It is a certificate 12A, and as we've said earlier, it's selling out across the board. Even with three cinemas in Cambridge, the opportunity of seeing anything remotely representative of the world, wealth of world cinema is impossible. As we've just discussed, they'll all be showing Spectre of the Lady in the Van. There's just too much, it's too varied and too difficult to gain access to. Hoping to address this imbalance a little bit is the Balak Arts Group. The group, which is based in London, has just begun a screening programme called A Taste of Anatolia, a series of monthly showings of new Turkish cinema. The programme launched in mid-October at the Light Cinema with a screening of the Turkish drama A Little Happiness and continues this coming Thursday, the 26th, with the award-winning Sivas. In the new year, we'll be looking in more detail at the current work being produced by Turkish cinema. But this week, I spoke to Jesse Wood, once projectionist at the Arts Picture House and now a freelancing film technician who is working with Balak Arts on A Taste of Anatolia. He spoke about the challenge of finding screening spaces for world cinema and the benefits of using boutique venues can actually bring. But to start, I asked him about his own background with Balak Arts.
So I've been involved with Balak Arts since 2014. I was brought in initially to help run a film festival in Northern Cyprus, which was the first film festival that's ever happened in Northern Cyprus. So off the back of that, myself and Yeshim Gazolpinar, who's the director of Balak Arts, thought it'd be a really good idea to carry on doing something similar closer to home. So we thought, well, we both live in Cambridge and there's a very, very large Turkish community here. It would be a good idea to take some of these films that we've been submitted or films that we've heard of and bring them to not just a Turkish audience in Cambridge, but actually to bring Turkish cinema to Cambridge.
The name of this programme that you just described, this is A Taste of Anatolia. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit more about that? Because it launched in mid-October, so it's not quite in full swing yet, but it's finding its feet.
Yeah, the name Taste of Anatolia came from Yeshim because she wanted something very evocative, very Turkish, without it being just Cambridge Turkish cinema. So that was launched a couple of months ago. We had a first screening at the Light Cinema of the film Little Happiness. We had Nihat Seven, who was the director, come along. Eventually, as things progress, we'd like to sort of branch out and feature more films from the area in general, the Mediterranean area, because it seems to be that it's a very underlooked part of Europe in terms of cinema. Everyone's familiar with the films of France and Germany, Italy, Spain, but towards the sort of end of Europe, like Turkey for example, it doesn't seem to be a lot of exposure for the films and the filmmakers there.
It's a much more casual experience you're describing. So in a way, the Light may not have been perfect. The next screening's at Emmanuel, I believe, the one coming up this Thursday, is that correct?
Yeah, so the next screening's on the 26th of November at Emmanuel College at the Queen's Theatre. Like we said, we're still sort of trying to find our feet and work out what the best way to move things forward. And the experience at the Light was great, but we're keen to sort of try different venues, find out where works for everybody. This is a real unknown and we're sort of poking around in the dark a bit, but we also like to sort of move venues around and keep it exciting because if you have it in one location, then it means some people might not be able to get there. But if you move it around and you keep it regular enough, then people will, if they come once, they'll be more inclined to come again and again. So the idea is to try and keep the momentum up and keep things fresh and, you know, always have something. So when we announce an event, we've already working on the next one after that, so there's always something in the pipeline.
And that fits well in. I mean, maybe even 5 years ago that would have seemed to be a disadvantage, but actually this movable feast is the way a lot of cinema is going. The recent Cambridge African Film Festival, yes, a lot of it was at the Arts Picture House, but it was at St. Philip's Church. It was at various different locations. And obviously, we've got one or two event cinema companies in Cambridge, groups that are doing this. St. John has screenings. Hot Numbers has screenings. This is very much the future of non-mainstream cinema going, I think.
Yeah, that's you mentioned the African Film Festival, and I think that's eventually the sort of area we'd like to head into, is actually to bring a mini festival, so build on these screenings and then sort of culminate with the Cambridge Turkish Film or the Cambridge Mediterranean Film Festival, something along those lines. The idea of actually having a mobile, movable cinema is very appealing to people. The idea of sort of going to the cinema on Saturdays and the multiplex thing, you know, people want something a bit different. So whether you're talking about doing it in the back room of a pub or in a church hall, it's keeping things new and exciting. And also with dealing with these, with this sort of what might be classed as smaller independent films, is that there isn't the sort of markup you have to pay to distributors, because a lot of these people are just very keen to have their film shown. So it gives us the ability to access lots of films where, if you were dealing with multiplexes, people would be asking for, you know, large figures to cover the rights to show the film, which obviously, with us being a charity-based organisation, we don't have. So it works in everyone's favour, really.
Ayşe, sen prenses olmaya kararını verdin mi? Sima!
Sima! Would you tell me a little bit more about the screening of Shivras, I believe, which is this Thursday at Emmanuel?
So, yeah, on Thursday, 26th of November at 7 o'clock at Emmanuel Queen's Theatre, there will be a free screening of the film Shivras, which is a film about a boy who forms a relationship with a dog who he rescues from a fighting circle. It premiered at Venice, at the 71st Venice Film Festival, where it won the special jury prize. And it was eventually picked up as the Turkish entry for foreign language at the Oscars in 2016. So it's a very, very big film, and it's obviously an important film for Turkey. So that's being screened at Emmanuel College on the 26th. It's free to get in. And also as part of that, Balık Arts, in partnership with the Civil Society Dialogue Project, which is a group run out of Izmir in Turkey, has produced a short film dealing with human rights and dealing with human rights in Turkey. So that we're going to screen that before, because also part of the project is to promote films that deal with issues, not just issues that affect Turkey, but issues that affect the wider European and worldwide community. So that's another aspect that we're going to try and bring in. So it's a free screening, so we encourage everyone to come along and see what it's all about. And also, it's a great film, and you don't want to miss up an opportunity to see a free great film, right?
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Jesse for the interview, which was done pretty much at the last moment. As mentioned earlier, we'll arrange to do a more thorough piece on current Turkish cinema, and it has a fascinating recent past, certainly in terms of the blockbusters it produces for its own audiences, and we'll have that in the new year. Meanwhile, Flavour of Anatolia screening of Shivas is this coming Thursday at 7 p.m. in the Queen's Building Theatre of Emmanuel College, and as mentioned there, it is free.
105 Sport. Join us every Saturday afternoon as we take a closer look at what's happening in the world of sport.
Follow all the weekend's local and national sport in action, plus a focus on the sporting activities in the community.
Join the 105 Sport team every Saturday from 2 to 5 p.m.
on Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
You are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, Community Radio in your city. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show today are Ashley, Bridget, Simon and Jack. Another busy day here on Cambridge 105. After we're all done at the top of the hour, there's another episode of Neil Meets, which this week has songwriter George Breakfast. That's followed by 105 Sport, as you've just heard, which today reports from the match between Cambridge United and Accrington Stanley. Between 5 and 6 p.m, it's then Rainbow Radio, which this week interviews the people behind Sexuality, an LGBT organisation in Cambridge for young people. Meanwhile, we've still got Starmen and Steve Jobs to come, but first we're off to the outback.
Myrtle Dunnage, you grew up.
You got old.
Myrtle Dunnage is back.
Haven't seen her since she was a kid. Wonder how she turned out.
How's my mother?
Molly doesn't get out much.
I don't know why you've come to this hole.
Who lives at Mad Molly's now?
She's back! The murderess is back!
I need to remember the truth.
They say that she killed a boy.
So where did you go from here?
I worked in London.
Milan and Paris.
I reckon you came home for one of two things, revenge or me.
Gertrude Pratt. The dance is Saturday night.
A dress can't change anything.
Watch and learn, Gertrude. Watch and learn. I can make you the most striking girl in the room.
It's been an astounding, depressing 18 years since the last feature film from Australian director Jocelyn Moorhouse. Her 1991 debut, Proof, was highly regarded at the time, but the few movies in the intervening years between that and her new film, The Dressmaker, suggest a messy sojourn in Hollywood and a lot of unfulfilled potential. Adapted by Moorhouse with her husband PJ Hogan, who made Muriel's Wedding, I believe, from the debut novel by Rosaline Ham, The Dressmaker begins as a beguiling mix of Babette's Feast and Pale Rider. Kate Winslet stars as Tilly Dunnage, a seamstress and a dress designer who strolls back into her Australian hometown for the first time since a childhood crime saw her banished. She's back to look after her ailing mother, played by Judy Davis, and hopes to soothe the town's suspicions with bespoke haute couture, which she whizzes up with the help of a sewing machine and supplies from Europe. But the snooty townsfolk believe Tilly is cursed, and no amount of Parisian catwalk style is going to change their mind. Bridget, The Dressmaker, it's a rare film in that you don't really know where one scene's going to end and where the next one's going to begin. It goes from A to Z by the most sort of rambling route possible. Does this make a nice change? Did you enjoy the journey?
Yes, nothing was predictable. I think part of the reason it went so many directions is because it's a small village and everyone has quite complex characters. They've all got backstories, they've all got secrets in their past, and as people interact more and we find out what's going on, this leads to all sorts of revelations and interesting changes in character dynamics.
Was it strong enough to because the problem is when you're based on a novel, and especially a debut novel, when the novelist might be trying to shoehorn as many of the ideas they've built up over the past few years into the story as possible, you can change tone willy-nilly almost because you've got words stretched across. Here, this is a film that changes tone from scene to scene. Some have found that jarring. Did it throw you a little bit? It could be comedy one moment, it could be not horror, but pretty unpleasant the next. And there's an element of social realism, certainly towards the treatment of women, that runs through the whole film.
I found it really refreshing. It was a film, much of which, like, I'd never seen before. When she starts out in the film, I'm thinking, what genre is this? I thought it was going to be a nice, gentle little comedy film.
Like Chocolate, but involving dresses.
Yeah,
it's what you think.
Everyone gets dresses and
lives happily ever after.
Or something. Yeah. But no, she turns up and it's like a cross between a Western and a noir as this femme fatale arrives and throws everyone's lives into disarray. I don't know quite how much of that's intentional.
I think that's we'll come back to that point, because I'm not quite sure about Tilly Dunnage's character and what aim she has. I think that might be a little bit part of the muddying of the narrative. Simon, the tones, this reminded me as a more successful attempt at the Barney Thompson film we saw earlier this year. Another film that jumped up and down in terms of tone.
Yeah, it is very inconsistent with tone. I mean, it starts off as the screwball slapstick comedy kind of thing, and then has brief dalliances with tragedy before ending pretty much on a very much of a black comedy note. It is a mixed tone, yet I didn't have any problem with that while watching, apart from one moment that did jerk me out of my seat a bit. But I won't go into that one. But apart from that, I mean, it's fantastic. The performances are absolutely wonderful. The characters are unpredictable. As you say, the story's unpredictable. You don't know where you need to go. It had that noir western, the way she came in the old town, in the middle of the outback, on a train, coming in, dropping her sewing machine like it was her gun holster or something like that, and you just know she's back for revenge and back for trouble. And I just never knew what was going to happen or how the characters are going to act, as you said. And, yeah, Kate Winslet and especially Liam Hemsworth as well were both absolutely fantastic.
Jack?
It's a film of four acts, and acts one, two and four are a lot of fun to watch. Act three takes itself so seriously that it gets really boring, and if you need to go and empty your bladder, as a few of us did in the cinema, that's probably the time to leave, because you can come back in and it'll get far more fun again.
It is only 2 hours. It's less than 2 hours, we should stress. It's not one of these 3.5 hour Hollywood epics.
It's only 2 hours.
But it does, yeah, just
feel
too long.
Like,
yeah.
It could have ended somewhere in Act 3 and that would have been satisfying. I really, really enjoyed it. I was agreeing with everyone. It opens like a Sergio Leone Western film. It kind of goes a bit Terrence Malick Days of Heaven with these open, expansive shots of the landscape around Australia. Then it moves into a bit of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and you've got Hugo weaving with all of his dresses. Then it kind of becomes, I don't know if you saw The Voices earlier on
yes.
the year from the director Persepolis, becomes a kind of twisted The Voices and then finishes somewhere near Quentin Tarantino bloodbath explosions. And I don't think I've seen a film where I can reference all of those films and say this is the component parts. And you've got Judy Davis as like Wurzel Gummidge up on the hill. It's like this cantankerous.
That's unfair. She's very good, Judy Davis. I haven't seen her for a while.
Awesome. I mean, to me, it struck me with Coen Brothers, but I think that's a little bit too simple. But if you enjoy the Coen Brothers, which most people should, this is the kind of film you'll probably get on fine with it. It's that kind of weird humour. You don't know what's going to happen, and it's great. And we just mentioned, of course, Hugo Weaving. Every time he appeared on screen, you just couldn't take your eyes off him.
He's playing fantastic. A different character. Yeah,
it's one of those
nice.
Characters that's going to go down in film history.
He looks just like John Waters with that pinstripe mustache.
He's just, not saying he's likeable, because that's the thing. The characters are all... Every character has a backstory, and they're all three-dimensional. And whether they're good or they're bad, none of them fit into a simple category. Yet that doesn't matter, because it's what they're doing now, which is what's important.
If there's a criticism other than Act 3, it's that it's a cinematography matter, and it really stuck out for me. Exteriors and high light, high colour saturation look great. When they go interiors and it's low light, it looks like they've shot it on like some cheap throwaway camera. They've got a really bad lens. Like I think that's just
Australia. Everything outside is just so bright. Yet inside, especially back then, you didn't have the light.
Yeah, it jumps from like HD to just, it looks tacky. It looks like a TV. It looks like what's the Australian soap?
Neighbours.
It looks like Neighbours, mate. Don't go there.
Maybe it is the interiors in Australia. I don't know. Maybe Simon's got a point. I want to end very briefly because I want to move on. But Bridget, I'm sorry to ask you this simply because you're the only female reviewer on this film. This is a woman director, and that's been sort of slightly ignored. And the film's been pretty poorly reviewed and rather insultingly reviewed in some cases and misunderstood. It has been described as chocolate with dresses. It isn't at all. It goes in a much different direction, and the dresses that she makes don't fix the problems. But there are certain elements in this film which would have been treated differently if there was a male director, and it's an unusual viewpoint. And it's not the dresses, it's the way the first kiss is handled and the way that it lingers on that and the momentum that how that becomes a salient point where another director might have treated, a male director might have treated it differently, or maybe not. But I felt there is a difference here in how certain scenes are made that I think probably should be underlined a little bit.
Yes, I'm not a male director, so I can't comment on how...
Well, neither am I,
but it felt... I really enjoyed watching it. I only realised at the end of the film how much of it was about women and how much of it was about middle-aged women. Mm-hmm. And
abused women, it deals...
Yeah. Beautiful. Yep. And I noticed the way they shot Liam Hemsworth, because at one point he's covered in mice and they managed to make that look appealing. And that's...
covered with mice is appealing. Women should give that much more...
Who wouldn't want to be covered in mice?
It should be a shirt design.
And you think John Hurt covered in rats in 1984, and it's a different...
It'll be all the fashion shoots next year.
There were a lot of... I want to talk about all the things I liked about the film. I don't want to talk about the ways in which it doesn't do the things I don't like in other films, but it mostly didn't do those things I don't like in terms of flailing help.
The best way you can probably appreciate, maybe the best way to appreciate this film is to imagine it made by somebody else and the mistakes it would make. It's not a perfect film in many respects. It does a lot. The tones don't always work for my mind, and I don't like the spaghetti western references, because you're using for comic effect something that was already used for comic effect. That's overkill. But it keeps doing things that if it was an American film starring, I don't know, Sandra Bullock or Nicole Kidman or somebody, it would do something different. And that's the relief of it, I think.
I think, yes, that things would happen like the women would start getting all enthusiastic about the dresses and the men in their life would say, why are you wasting time on these fripperies? And we don't get any of that.
No,
we get
none
to
at
see
all,
the
yeah.
transformation that the dresses have on people's lives, and it's not that a dress, as they say in the trailer, a dress doesn't solve anything, a dress can't change anything.
But it does have an effect, and I think that's an effect that the film, another film, might not have pointed out. I think that
different effect on different people. Some people yeah. blossom, some people turn into more The Devil Wears Prada yeah. characters.
I thought, I agree with you. I think
everyone's got scope to change.
Yeah. I think that's where the film is at its most intelligent and its most worthwhile. That's not the best word to use when I'm struggling with syntax today. Anyway, okay, all right, thank you very much. The Dressmaker opened yesterday, November 20th, yesterday, mm-hmm. and is showing at the Arts Picture House. It is a certificate 12A.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You're indeed listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. But we get a move on here. Not every movie that premieres at the Cambridge Film Festival is lucky enough to find a distributor for a wider UK release, but after opening the festival back in early September, this week sees the return of documentary Starmen, a melancholic glimpse of science past and the future of the universe. The film follows four English astronomers, all now scientists in their late 70s, embarking on a road trip that mirrors the explorations they took as young English scientists stationed in America in the 50s. They revisit their old walking routes and the telescopes, some now fallen into disrepair, where they spent many, many nights getting to grips with the cosmos. Just before the film's festival debut, I spoke with Alison Rose, the producer, writer and director of Starmen. Speaking to me from her film studio in downtown Toronto, Alison explained her reasons for filming the trip and the difficulty in finding drama in the unsentimental logic of scientists. But she began by discussing what had brought her to the project in the first place.
I'm 76 and I'm aware that I will not live forever. And there are many things that I should still like to do. I like to follow my stars a lot longer than I have done already. Maybe I shall last a little time yet.
I wanted to make a particular kind of astronomy film. And so I was looking for a particular story that was going to occur naturally. And I didn't know what that was. But I was just sort of waiting to bump into it. And Starmen is the film that I found. I knew one elderly British astronomer who lived in Arizona and whom I met making my first film. And then I met another elderly British astronomer and I asked the second if he knew the first. And he said, "Know him? I'm planning a reunion with him. We're going to take a road trip." And so the film weaves together basically five story threads. One was the old road trip. One was the new road trip. Another thread was the biographies, the stories of those four men. Another theme was 50 years in astronomy, the post-war 50 years in astronomy, which were the most exciting 50 years that astronomy has ever had. And the final fifth thread is my thread as the narrator and guide to the audience. That's basically what you see is a weave of those five story threads. Some of them are a little thicker than others, which is appropriate.
Did the road trip with Donald and with Nick and with Wall and with Roger, did it take the shape you were expecting?
Initially, I wanted to just follow them on their road trip. And then later on, I revisited that and asked them to go to the VLA. I also asked them to go to California. I thought for the purposes of the film and their biographies, for the story of astronomy in the 20th century, we had to go there. And I think that the structure of the film bears that out. There was a reason I wanted to go with them. I wanted to learn from them. There were questions I wanted to ask them about not just their science, in fact, less about their science and more about what they'd learned in a lifetime, what their thoughts were about life.
Starmen features a whole lot of themes, as you've just mentioned, that many films, even documentaries, tend to avoid. Age, mortality, science in a serious sense rather than a sort of summer blockbuster sense, and, as I mentioned earlier, joy and importance of reading, of education, of curiosity, and the value of asking questions. None of these are ever fashionable in film. Did you plan to address subjects that seemed almost ridiculously alien nowadays?
I wanted to celebrate that. I wanted to celebrate a love of learning and getting to do what you loved as a child for your entire life and have that be a life of exploration and learning and friendship, you know, married with friendship because you make friends with people in common interests. That's my subversive motive in making this film.
There's a decent chance that there are about 10 billion planets in this galaxy that might have life develop on them. And there are about 100 billion galaxies spread through the universe. And our success or failure is hopefully not important in the long run. We are just one of the many experiments necessary, and somewhere someone gets through.
One of the surprising things, and I think one of the things that will be a surprise when it screens at the festival, was that none of the four men are inclined towards sentiment at all. I wondered if this lack of sentimentality, which they must have as scientists, made making a film about them more difficult than it might have done.
Yes. Nick's just being extremely practical. And in fact, Wall was extremely sentimental, I would say, but he kept it well hidden. He's got a huge heart. And I think they all do. It was work, but filmmaking is work. And to be honest, they're also British and they are of a certain age, a certain generation, and they're quite reserved and stoic, stiff upper lip, that kind of thing. So yes, it was hard, but I think we succeeded. I think there's real emotional resonance in the film.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Alison for the interview, which was very generously squeezed into a very busy day for her. Starmen opened at the Arts Picture House last night and is screening once a day all week. Is that true, Jack? It's once a day, yep. Okay. Well, thank you. We're heading... I was looking for some more stats, but never mind. You can't always be there. We're heading into cinema's award season now, so beware, the biopics could come thick and fast. First out of the blocks is Steve Jobs, an ambitious attempt by director Danny Boyle and writer Aaron Sorkin to squeeze a revolutionary career into a compact and delightfully Moorish package. Unlike the generic Hollywood biopic, Steve Jobs doesn't offer a whole life. Rather, it reenacts the backstage drama, the three major product launches, the first Apple Macintosh computer, the next computer Steve Jobs designed as an impossible rival to Apple after he had been made redundant, and the sleek translucent iMac that heralded his triumphant return to the company he'd helped start. Each section plays out like a soap opera screwball comedy, with Steve Jobs, played by Michael Fassbender, a whirling dervish of invention, insult, sharpened wits and blunt paranoia. Ashley, at one stage during Steve Jobs, one of the technicians, played by Seth Rogen, says, "What do you actually do?" to Michael Fassbender, Steve Jobs. "What do you actually do? You don't do this, you don't do this, but why are you Steve Jobs?" Does the film... Fassbender has a pat answer for that, for Steve Jobs' answer for that, but does the film delve any more deeply into what made this man tick?
I wouldn't say so, but I don't think it's supposed to. It's stuck with the three product launches. That's the only thing we see of him at work. You see no more of his life, but you definitely get the sense that he is just this overarching genius. That's what he does. So I really liked him, which might make me a bit of a sociopath, but to compare him to Ashton Kutcher's Steve Jobs, who was this sort of tightly wound maniac, Fassbender's just this serene, all-purveying, all-seeing, quietly deadly genius. That's what he does. He's Steve Jobs.
That's not good enough. he's Steve Jobs.
He's Steve Jobs. She's Madonna, he's Jobs.
That's a very Buddhist answer. Simon, Danny Boyle said in interviews that he was, when he got Sorkin's script and he came in this after Fincher had been briefly involved, and obviously Fincher had made The Social Network, that he had the same problem as Fincher had. He had blocks of text in acts with no stage direction. Fincher gave The Social Network his sheen and also put a lot of sort of Great Gatsby themes into it. What does Boyle do with Steve Jobs? Is it just simply enough to make it work? Because obviously that's difficult enough.
He certainly gives it energy, gives it tension, builds up to it. It's reading the description of the film is, you know, three product launches, backstage, that's it. It's just all talkings, it's Sorkin, and that's what you're mainly going for, to be honest. Yet it was gripping from the beginning to the end. Mm-hmm. There are twists, the way the flashbacks worked, the amazing performances, not just from Michael Fassbender, but
Kate Winslet.
I was going to say Kate Winslet is almost recognisable. Jeff Bridges is absolutely superb, and even Seth Rogen, who's not just playing a technician, he's playing Woz.
I know. I couldn't remember his name. Yes, he's playing the co-designer of the Mac.
Guy who actually designed it, and all of it's just. Although it's probably easy to mess up an Aaron Sorkin script, I presume. I'm not a director either. But what you see on screen is absolutely, fascinating. Cannot take my eyes off it for a single moment. I was, the twist that came in, I just could not. It's absolutely brilliant. I mean, the big difference we were just saying beforehand between Fincher and Boyle is Fincher puts his stamp on it. With Social Network, you could watch that and you know it's David Fincher. This one, it's not a Danny Boyle film. You wouldn't necessarily put it in with the other Danny Boyle.
It feels more like a gun for hire film, which is not necessarily a criticism.
He is a very competent director to do this. So, to be honest, I don't think you're going to be looking at any best acting nods in the award season for it.
Best acting or best directing?
Sorry, best directing. Yep. Sorry, best directing nods for it. But I think it's a shoo-in for script, at least, and probably quite a lot of nominations, if pretty much all the cast.
Bridget, very quickly, we've got another 4 or so minutes, but this film is actually quite strange in its structure. Not the fact that it's simply three product launches, but they're almost fever dream scenes in the fact that Aaron Sorkin has brought in real events from all of that period, that 14-year-old period of Jobs' life, and added them into these product launches. So his daughter's always there, floating around sometimes in the background like an imaginary friend. Does that work? Does this, because it was almost like a Fellini film in some ways, and in the operatic nature of it. Is it a good way of getting across a man's life?
By the third product launch, I was beginning to think maybe he should run them differently if he's going to have so many emotional conflicts always happening an hour before launch.
To be fair, he does say that. He does have that line, why does it happen just before launch?
So the film has created this circus-like atmosphere that didn't actually exist in order to get these narrative points across.
Yes, it didn't feel naturalistic, but it was very engaging and drove a lot of character. In a brief time.
Did the idea of the running theme of his daughter, who's very young in the very first scene when he won't recognise it, she's his daughter, and to the end of the film when she's grown up and a freshman and there's a bonding scene on top of a car park, did that all work? Because that came across as a little bit sort of pat to me, a little bit sort of trying to find a traditional... We've spoken a lot about what other films would do if somebody else made them. This feels like what a Hollywood film would do with this story.
You can read it that way, as there's a gradual bonding and development of their relationship, and you can also read it as we've seen the level of control he takes over all the other aspects of his life. Is he just picking things to say because they think they will get things to turn out the way he wants?
Is it seeing his daughter as yet another product? It doesn't quite become that callous, but it does raise that issue.
How do you manage your employees? How do you manage your relationship with your daughter? And it's not about compassion for them.
He only really started to like her when she made that Well, I won't ruin the nice moment, but there's a moment where she engages.
Well, she uses the closed end system in the way that he imagines it's going to be used. She's the only one who sees
it.
She's
his daughter all of a sudden.
She's an advert.
I should say I love the film as well, but if there's a disclaimer to the film, it's that it suffers from... We sometimes talk about counter-programming when you have a big film release and there's like an art house film that is released at the same time. I think Steve Jobs in America and in the UK has suffered from problematic programming in that it's being programmed in at a time where it's up in direct competition with, in America, with Spectre and Peanuts, the movie, which has done really well. In the UK, it opened in a week where Spectre's still doing strong, Lady in the Van has just opened, and Brooklyn...
That, none of those things helped, but I genuinely was surprised anybody greenlit this film. I'm surprised anybody thought, well, the life of the head of Apple but most people might have his products, but it doesn't mean they want to see the story of the man, as fascinating as it is.
I saw a story about it being launched in American 2,500 cinemas in screens.
Crikey, really?
And in the second week, it got pulled about 2,000 of them, and they say it's one of the biggest pulling ever. I mean, what I took away from that was I was shocked somebody actually put it on the 2,500 screens.
I think some executive said everybody who has a phone will go see this, and no.
You know, it's not an Apple fans will go see it. Aaron Sorkin fans will go see it, because... But he's probably, you know, I keep mentioning him. He's the bigger pull. If you ever
he is the draw of this film.
He is the draw of the film, and it's a fantastic film. But
and ironically, when it in its first week in America, when it was just in about 500 cinemas, which is small for America, it did really well as a screen average. And then when you add those extra 2,000,
all right, let's not get boiled down with too much with numbers. We'll become a grandstand or whatever.
I primarily went to see it because I'm not a big Apple user, but I've heard of the cult of Jobs and the reality distortion field, and I wanted to see how this actually worked out.
And it doesn't deal with that, though. That's where, we don't have very long here, but that's where the film fails, is it doesn't look into that.
Very quickly, Kate Winslet touches on it right at the end, but there is that brilliant Fassbender facial moment where it all clicks for him, like, whoopsie, I've been running my life wrong up until this point. Let's fix this before I die in 10 years.
Yeah, I think that's where it fails in comparison with The Social Network. The Social Network spoke of a lot of issues with the last generation in this age. This film is just exciting to watch because of the dialogue. There's nothing else there, and I think that's the Danny Boyle effect. Anyway, okay. Well, Steve Jobs opened only last week, and as we've discussed, has real trouble locating an audience. Its time at the Arts Picture House has already passed, but it is still screening at the Light. It is a Certificate 15. That's all we have time for on the show. The podcast will be available in a couple of days, and you can catch up with everything we've done in the past few months via the Cambridge 105 website, which is www.cambridge105.fm. We're also to be found on iTunes, Facebook and Twitter. We'll be back on Saturday the 4th of December with a show that's just ridiculously crowded. Bridge of Spies, The Good Dinosaur, Carol, Sunset Song, spoil for choice. We'll play out with some Creedence Clearwater Revival. But from everybody, and please stay tuned for Neil Meets, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.